Gentlemen, you're both drunk on cosmic wine.
Welcome to the show. I'm Dr. Mark Sylvester.
And I'm Dr. Richard Schulman.
This is All Psych.
We're live on tape.
Yay!
Welcome to the internet. Have you ever been here before?
Been here once or twice before.
I hear you're a resident professional. It's my honor and privilege to welcome you to the electron space that is the Zoom. Dr. Lita Fatemi, thank you for being here. It's quite the catch, because I feel that we are kindred spirits, and talking a little bit beforehand, I like to think have a similar background, but why don't you tell our viewers how unsimilar our background is?
First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful to be here in this wonderful, beautiful space that you've created.
Virtual.
I mean, that's amazing that we can do this, right? I mean, we have to have our gratitude for technology too. And so, yeah, I'm from Iran originally. I don't know if you guys know, there's a lot of things happening in Iran, a lot of opening of old wounds coming out about human rights violations that I lived under for the first 14 years of my life. And it was a theocratic dictatorship, the epitome of marriage of state and church. Stay away from that. All costs possible, because it's anti-human is really what happens.
And a lot of countries struggle there in that department.
Yes. And so right now it's the cry for freedom, which is really cool, because it's a women started this whole movement of revolution, evolution. It's the evolution of consciousness and shedding of the old skin is really what's happening. But in the meantime, a lot of people are dying and tortured and raped and all those things that are, you know, really hard to see and, you know, be connected to, because it is my country. But came to America as a teenager, went straight to American high school, didn't know any English. That was fun. But very grateful for it. I was very depressed for about 3 years in high school, had no friends, missed home, missed my childhood, missed the innocence that I was a part of, though it was a, you know, my parents created a very beautiful container of love and security for us, though on the large scale, you know, we lived in war for the first 8 years of life. There was no electricity for days, no water for days, you know, food insecurity, all of those things were a part of my growing up. But you don't know any difference, and you're just, you know, you're fish in the water, you're swimming in it, you don't know you're in water. And, you know, fast forward to, you know, now I'm 10 years out of, you know, being a hospitalist at University of New Mexico. And at the end of my reign in hospital medicine, recognizing those, you know, years of living in Iran under that theocratic regime as, you know, all the traumas that I had endured. And, you know, in the recent years, I've just been able to become more aware of it through my burnout. So that's the greatest gift, right? It's like our trauma tends to be our greatest gift, or like times of difficulty, times of challenge tend to be that. And so I, instead of, you know, for some time I did try to run away from it, and that didn't not go well. And so I was like, okay, I gotta go in it. So then I did, and I have had some lived experience using psychedelics, getting through my traumas, micro, macro, all of it, you know. And so now I sit here with you talking about, you know, whatever you want to talk about.
Well, so we're definitely going to talk about psychedelics, specifically The Shift, which I purposely took a nebulous title because that's really a triple entendre. But I would say the thing that fascinates me about you is, like you said, you're born into this country, to in Iran. You're born into this time the struggles of the zeitgeist of that country and its geopolitical strife. You're born as a female in an unequal type of culture. Do you think that upbringing had anything to do with pushing you into understanding more about yourself, more about the universal consciousness, understanding more about the mind? Because it seems to me like you have this sort of secret double life. You blend in great here in America, and you're down in the trenches with the best of the best right now, you know, making sure our healthcare system continues to churn on some of the toughest work, internists, and you're in academia. I'm picturing like a Viktor Frankl type of experience. Do you think that your upbringing led you into your interest in consciousness and understanding, pursuing consciousness?
Absolutely. You know, I think my parents had a really big part in all of this. When I was little, it is a theocratic regime, meaning the law of Islam, however they interpret it, however the state interprets it, rules the people also, in addition to the other governing, you know, bodies, you know, that make law. In that very dark space that we lived in under extreme oppression and suppression, my parents were always seekers of a more conscious life. And they would take us to underground meetings with that had to do with Buddhism. Hmm. Krishnamurti had to do with Hinduism. And these were literally underground, where we had, you know, there were guards up top, making sure that the government people don't, the morality police don't see where we're going and what's happening. And they would warn if, you know, there was suspicious activity. So from a very young age, I started being exposed to other ways of being, living, being conscious. And then around age 12, I was introduced to a spiritual path. My parents introduced us to it and started meditating avidly at that age.
Do you think that there was a component of escape to it? I mean, we're mm-hmm. going to be talking about psychedelics and kind of how they shift your perspective, and they allow you to either see things underneath or view things that are in front of you through a different lens. Similarly, did you feel like the same type of experience happened? Like when you have a trauma, sometimes it's not uncommon to dissociate. So I'm wondering if growing up in that that tension and fear of literally meditating, right? You have an armed guard to protect you while you're meditating. Do you think that that helped kind of dissociate you and push you and create that hunger to access that space? Not just because you're not supposed to be doing it and you're a kid and you're gonna say, "What? I'm not supposed to." But more just as a human, like this is a safe place. This is where I feel unjudged. You know, if my ego's dissolved, we're not worried about how old I am, male, female, professional, homeless, Buddhist, atheist, whatever.
Yes. And I love how you bring that in. That's a beautiful perspective and very true. I not only used, you know, meditation during that time, but 2 years later, we came to America and went to an all-American high school. It was a great high school. But being, you know, ripped away from my community and connection in my Persian culture is a really big deal. I felt, you know, this fracture that had happened. And so 3 years of high school, I would sit and meditate for an hour and a half a day, you know, and yes, you know, that I was connecting with my freedom,
mm-hmm.
free self that had no shackles to anything from this world. that could fly away whenever she wanted to and absolutely be whatever she wanted to be, an animal, a bird, a, you know, whatever, you know, a, just a little sparkle of light. Yes, there's a quite a freedom in that, you know, and knowing that in that space you are free. I think that was a really beautiful thing that I learned about the inner work, you know? Yeah.
Well, and fast forward a little bit, because that little girl grows up into a professional woman with less constraints that society's imposing on you in a lot of ways, but there's still that eager curiosity about you that fascinates me because people are tired, they're burnt out, generally unpleasant. Certainly the anxiety and the fear that's palpable in the air is affecting everybody, and people like you that can remain the calm in the center of the storm, that are actually energy givers when so many people are just craving and hungering energy in any way, shape, or form that they can get, basically. You're still able to access that. You're still able to, you know, go to work, do the hospital job, but then also hold space for connecting with your patients on a very personal level, on a sacred level, on a spiritual level, especially with moms. You know, you mentioned that you could relate as a single mom trying to balance all of this, but then also put yourself first, right? It's hard to remember to put the oxygen mask on yourself before your child.
Yeah.
How do you do it? What's the secret to life?
Oh man.
The viewers want to know.
Okay. Conscious life practices. That's the secret. And that's what I learned after I ran myself to the ground for many years, right? And subscribed myself to really the abusive system that sick care is. It's not health care, it is sick care. So, I think, you know, having gone through the traumas that I've gone through and the oppression and all of that, it's really interesting that, I don't know, it's part of your subconscious or conscious. You may have a lot more perspective on this, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it, is having had trauma, you are more prone into going into fields where the same constraints, because it's part of your pattern and it feels comfortable and you know it. So you go in it. Like, I know how to thrive in a system that's abusive. Thrive. Like, I mean, and I made the hospital system thrive, you know, in ways that when I look back, I'm even surprised, you know.
Yeah.
But I understand systems very easily and very quickly. And I'm like, oh, I figure it out. I'm like, okay, this is what we need to do this and improve that. And, you know, but I do think that has a lot to do with my past patterns of trauma, or my micro traumas and cultural traumas and givings, you know. So, you know, to go back to your question of what is the secret, the secret is, you know, a fewfold, I would say, is want. I wanted not to be burnt out. I wanted to have this vital energy force within me all the time. I committed to myself, and I, really got to know me in a different way. I had, during my burnout, I had lost myself. I didn't, you know, my essence, I wasn't connected to anymore. You know, that source connection wasn't there anymore, but you got to get lost before you can find yourself truly. So putting my pieces back together for a couple of years, it took me a few years to do this work. And I'm still doing it. Every day I engage in conscious life practices, and consistency. Doing it every single day, staying consistent with it. That's how I'm able to keep going and be, and provide the energy that I can, you know. And Because that self-care is a container of self-compassion. And when I'm serving me, that's the greatest service I can give this world, is I can be present. I can give this energy and I don't feel at all tired or fatigued, because I know that, let's say after our interview today, I'm going to go and hold a container for myself again. I did that this morning. I did that for 10 minutes, you know, this afternoon, and this evening I'm going to do it, you know, meditation, lay in the sun, you know, just do what it is that I feel is feeding my soul, play with my plants, you know, and not be shy about it.
So we talk a bunch, that's a really good point. We talk a bunch about that on this show and helping people, like you said, realize something's wrong. Something's not, something's off, something's unacceptable. And I think most people would recognize that as, I'm tired. I feel like nothing's ever going my way. I'm working, and I, you know, still can't afford this or that, or kind of just this learned helplessness attitude, certainly a chronic trauma that is shared. Interestingly, although we all act like we're the only ones going through it, it is a shared trauma. We all crave that connection and hunger for that connection. But I don't think people are ready or know intuitively what to do and how to do it. So let's talk a little bit about how psychedelics can jumpstart that, how they can shift your perspective, maybe their role in clinical medicine, because there's some logistical barriers. Most are illegal. But backing up a little bit, when I first started getting interested in psychedelics, it was sort of for a similar reason, because you've been interested in this in a long time. Your undergraduate work was in neuroscience and behavioral biology. I essentially did the exact same thing, a master's in neuropsychopharmacology and psychobiology, which is probably the exact same thing. It's literally how drugs affect the brain and why. So you have to know a little bit about the brain's organic hardware, postulate how it's putting out its software, which is hard to do if you don't agree on the concept of a soul or some sort of a ethereal being, ethereal body, but also the dosages, the targets, what these neuronal tracts and these receptors, there's a lot of neuroscience involved in your spirituality, which to me is very rare. And I'm fascinated by that, one, because that's kind of the way that I think. And I thought, hey, that's just you, buddy, that thinks like that. But there's, with you, it seems like there's this sense of trying to marry the Western understanding of medicine in science as a dovetail into the spiritual practices and the daily routines, things that you do personally that might be different for the next person, to essentially the conscious living tools you were talking about, to raise your vibration, to shut down that left brain, you know, physician, ego, mother, all of that good stuff. At what point did you decide, hey, I think psychedelics are something that I'm interested in exploring myself personally?
Well, I think it was an evolution over time. I started, you know, as you said, neuroscience, I was always fascinated by the brain and neuroplasticity. And I love it that at Emory, at that time, I graduated in 2003 from Emory. And at that time, you know, neuroplasticity in the adult brain did not exist, right? And in all these, you know, scientific papers and da, 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 and you know, it was what it was. And you're like, okay, fine. And we talked about songbirds, where their brain is plastic and during seasons it changes and so forth. And to me, you know, as I was, then I started reading, I took classes, of course, in addiction and behavior and how it works in the brain. And, you know, and then just seeing some evidence of, you know, depression shrinks the brain, meditation, you know, makes the brain bigger, you know, all those things. I'm like, that is not unplastic, y'all. Like,
yeah.
And then I was following with the research at the time, like through Hopkins. There were some older ones through Dr. Strassman in the 1990s, spirit molecule DMT. And I just found it fascinating, but I was not going to touch it just because culturally also for me, it was like, no way, you don't use any mind altering substances, you know, and this is with the new regime, right? Of course, everything is a sin. You know, alcohol is completely banned in the country. And you know, not to say that people at parties don't have alcohol, they make their own alcohol or they import it somehow. Sorry, my Zoom just did something funny.
You zoomed on and zimmed.
Okay, there we go. When was it exactly? I think it was when I just didn't see any other way. And I had learned that there are other ways, like, and why not, you know? And that's when my husband and I, you know, he's my second husband, and we met in residency and we started talking, and he studied neuroscience at UC Davis. Mm. And very, you know, well informed. We started talking about cannabis, and cannabis was a big deal for me. Like, marijuana was like, what are you talking about, you know? And you know, with marijuana, I started, you know, experimenting and seeing how it makes me feel, you know, as a tool to look at myself from a different angle, not to like lose my mind, you know, although that if you're doing that, that's great too, but to really get to know yourself from different angles. I think, you know, the spiritual path that I've been on, it's about path of self-discovery. And I believe that source is always trying to evolve. And if we are tapped into our own source and we are in alignment, then we want to, our consciousness is constantly trying to evolve. And if we constantly say no, 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 then we're creating these blockages in our own evolution. And so having, you know, carried some of these spiritual practices, thoughts, you know, with me, it really helped me in this realm too, to be more open-minded, you know, and, you know, I've had some difficult experiences with psychedelics as well. And I think that should be absolutely talked about also. You know, I was with, you know, supervision and, you know, in a legal setting, because in the US is not legal. There's some South American and Central American countries that it is. Legal, or there's just ambiguous. It's so part of their culture that just doesn't, the law is, it's not even part of the law, you know, they don't talk about it. So, but, you know, through that, I was able to really move through my fears and my anxieties and see them for what they are. And that they're not a part of me. It's actually, I'm the eye of the storm, and you know, all of this is happening out here. And I was able to see that. I was able to see, and once it wasn't a part of me, then I could really move through life and flow through life. And it wasn't just the psychedelic, it was the work that I did around it too, you know? And I think that is something that rings so true with me from my lived experience. And, you know, other people that come to me, you know, for guidance, I'm like, you have to have integration afterwards with trusted people who hold you in a container of love and are non-judgmental, and they're here to observe you as you're going through your journey. And I think it's awesome to have practitioners like yourself, you know, hold that space for people. And yeah, so long answer, but you know.
Well, so how do we create that in the clinical world? Because I, you know, it's not the best example, but we were talking before the show about cannabis and how unusual it was for it to be federally illegal for so many decades, and not one scientist or researcher on any level ever was allowed to do any research. And then poof, literally overnight, it's legal in most states and medical in the rest. And interestingly, people do come and they ask me questions. Hey, do you think medical marijuana is good for me or whatever? I'm always the first to say, I don't know. I don't know much about it. I'm not trained in it. I guess it's a two-part question. One, are we going to see similar psychoactive plant medicines? Let's just stick to for a second. Are we going to see them kind of become medications, like a lot of the studies with MDMA or when I was at University of Miami with Deborah Mash, Ibogaine is another one that's been studied a lot for heroin addiction, and of course, ketamine and alcohol and Krupitsky's work, or Rick Strassman and DMT. How do we get through the logistical barriers? Forget the existential part of it. How do we study these? How do we bring them to their patients?
You know, I think, you know, you brought up a great example, cannabis, right? Let's like step into that world. It's, I don't know any other physician within my group that knows much about cannabis at all. And I think, you know, being an educator, I'm in academics because I love education, you know, but I'm just, you know, as I'm leaving the university, I'm going to continue my education on a broader spectrum, which I'm very grateful for. But I think education is absolutely number one. We got to talk about these things. I've been talking to my patients about it for the past few years, because when CBD became legalized, and then, you know, and then I knew, okay, THC is going to also become legalized. So let's talk about it. Like, it's, you know, these things that we make so taboo, you know, and that comes from, you know, me being censored for such a long time as a child, you know. Now I'm like, no, I used to censor myself in America as well. And now I'm out of that phase because I've worked through my traumas, and I'm like, no, we have to talk about it. Let's talk about it. How much CBD do you use? Do you use CBD? I have no idea what it is. Okay, so if you go to the dispensary, you know, if you use it with opioids, it actually enhances the mu receptors and it can actually bind better. And in the brain, you know, pathways, it works better. Here are the ratios, 20 to 1, 10 to 1, you know? So the part of what I want to do is that, you know, educate the masses on how to use these as medicines. And, you know, so that's the cannabis part. The rest of these molecules, you know, we're seeing ketamine being extremely regulated, which I'm all for. I think that's fine. I think when we get to the more ancient medicines, like psilocybin, peyote, you know, mescaline, when we get into that, or maybe ayahuasca, I don't have a lot of experience or knowledge about ayahuasca, like small amounts, just because it's so culturally ingrained in certain cultures. And I think that's where it needs to be happening, you know? But as far as like psilocybin, let's just give an example. Recently, a pharmaceutical company came out with the synthetic psilocybin, and which makes me concerned, you know, because historically, up till now, the pharmaceutical companies have failed us because they put money above all. Insurance companies do the same thing. They put money above all. So when we're talking about human rights violations, I think there's a lot of that happens, but it's not on, you know, on the surface. So people aren't having riots about it, you know?
Well, we're brainwashed in this country. One thing that almost universally anyone notices the very, very quickly when they come to this country is that our television advertises pharmaceuticals. And that's something we Americans have been brainwashed and indoctrinated. And honestly, it's no different than Burger King or T-Mobile. And that is very rare. And it's very bizarre if you can step outside of yourself. I'm sure you noticed that coming here at 14, like they're advertising a food product or, you know, go ask your doctor about this. And interestingly, I get more and more, especially over the last 3 years, more and more questions about psychedelics. Hey, you know, doc, what do you think about microdosing LSD?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
look, I don't know.
Help me with that. No, it's illegal. What do you think about macrodosing psilocybin? Like,
yeah.
Good. Yeah. You know, there's, as physicians, not only can we not legally obtain these things, with the exception of ketamine and cannabis now, I guess, some mm-hmm. of us, how do we guide these people if we think that the psychedelic shift is something beneficial and their transpersonal evolution of their own psychology or their own trauma?
Yeah.
How do we get from A to B? Because I think there's tremendous potential, but here marijuana just flipped out of nowhere and it's sort of over the counter. And yet, like you said, now we have a drug like ketamine, which I have published a ton on. One of my business partners was doing it 40 years ago, and psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. So not the ketamine model that we see now, where it's, you know, shove this up your nose, it'll help your depression. It was a lot more of the set and setting, the transpersonal, like you said, holding non-judgmental space, keeping people safe, helping them integrate and post-process. It's part of a much bigger process than just going, even if you go to South America and do an ayahuasca trip, that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be the best set and setting, that you're the appropriate person, totally. That the shaman that you ran into totally. That was closer to the port isn't more of a charlatan than the one deeper in the jungle.
Yes, yes, yes. No, I mean, you bring up a great question. I think this is something that we're at the forefront of. And I think as we talk about it, I think, you know, it kind of raises those questions of, you know, is this the right thing for me? If somebody is called to it, I would say, you know, sit with that guide. Sit with them, see how they feel to you now, with the caveat that if you have spent the past 50 years not knowing yourself, you're probably going to choose the wrong person. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you have not engaged with yourself, understanding what is right for me and what is wrong, and you have not listened to your intuition ever, or you've never done a therapeutic session — I'm not saying everybody should go to therapy, I'm saying a therapeutic session and in a connected space with another human being, where you've been able to evaluate yourself and your vulnerabilities and potential past traumas of having some kind of perspective about yourself, then I would say, if you've done that type of work, then you can evaluate another person energetically. And if you can evaluate that person energetically and there is a good match, then I would say, okay, you know, but you have to do the work yourself. I mean, right now that's where we are, you know, because you're right. Everything is illegal and we can't do any of that unless it's the research setting, right? Like clinical trial or, you know, and do your research, you know, don't go with the first guide. If they are overly charismatic and they're trying to convince you, be wary, you know, be very going to it with conscious awareness that the first person you meet is not going to be it, even though they may say many beautiful things that feel good to you. And maybe this is the first time you're hearing somebody say beautiful things to you. And is that what's happening? You know? So I think a lot of it is really and honestly about that self-discovery piece that a lot of us are not connected to, you know?
Well, so that's
the time.
Isn't that the chicken and the egg, though? Because on one hand, I'm thinking, you know what, pump the psychedelics in the water supply and let the chips fall where they may. You know, it can't be any worse off than we are now. It's sort of this Hail Mary, insane type of thought, truthfully, although we've certainly done it to other countries. You know, LSD in very, 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 very tiny doses can have profound debilitating effects, certainly on unsuspecting ingesters. You know, the big experiments they did with the British soldiers, it pretty much reduced their army to a bunch of blithering idiots. So these things could be used, weaponized, they could be used certainly recreationally. And you know, we talked about the raves. You don't hear much about them anymore with the ketamine and stuff like that. But really, all of the sacraments, we can't talk too much about in terms of prescribing them or using them in a clinical setting. We can kind of help people maybe interpret experiences that they may have recreationally. I don't really feel terribly great about that, even though there's no impropriety or anything illegal. I try to teach people that the sacrament, that the chemical isn't what's giving you the experience. It's setting up the conditions for you to uncover. Or rediscover or re-remember, or gain a different perspective. So is it a chicken or the egg? Give people psychedelics so that they can unplug from the matrix, or like you said, the daily practices, consciousness raising tools, certainly holotropic breathwork, meditation, yoga, tai chi, things like that work as well. And then maybe get people to a raised sense of awareness where they would then go, ooh, I want to take this to a higher level and do deeper work with a plant-based medicine.
I think it's an interplay, and I think one informs the other and it accelerates the other. I think, number one, to me, you know, and I've been able to guide people through in countries where it is legal. And the best outcomes have been the ones that have done the work before, been within a beautiful, loving container, and did work after. And that work after continues on. You know, it's like that, it escalates and then it comes down. And it's like, you know, you're rooting in yourself. You know, doing these life practices, then you keep rooting those practices into your life and whatever you learned about yourself. What I see it as, you know, doing the work beforehand is very important. It's like coming up on this very long shore at the beach instead of having a drop off, you know, like jumping into the abyss.
Deep, yeah.
You know, instead it's the work before with conscious life practices, what I've observed and what I've been told is it's kind of like, okay, I'm getting my feet wet about my own consciousness. Oh, I am conscious. Oh, am I? I'm not conscious about this, but I'm conscious about that, you know, now, but I haven't been conscious for the past 50 years. I've literally had people tell me this, that I have lived an unconscious life for the past 50 years. And now I have these teenagers who are about to graduate and I don't know what to do. And it's very scary to me because I've lived this. I've just been projecting my patterns forward, you know, of being parented or cultures or whatever. Yeah. And so it's like that, you know, going to the shoreline and getting your feet wet and then getting down to the ankles and the knees and then, you know, swimming into it with gentleness. So that's what that provides. Now, if somebody's looking to just like, you know, uncover it all, you know, which I don't recommend just because we may not be ready to uncover it all. There may be even hidden memories of past traumas that are hidden for a reason, you know, and to go more slowly, because nature does things slowly, other than when there's a hurricane, I feel like. And even the hurricane, it starts slowly. It's not, it's like a lot of different things that have to come together to create that storm, right? To create a tree, it takes years and years, right? It's like a seed that you plant. So I'm much more of a proponent of that model that mimics nature, that things are slow and gentle and beautiful. And that when you do recognize those past traumas, you know, you lift it up a little bit and you're like, oh, this is happening. This is, you know, and for some people that's microdosing, you know, microdosing does that for them. But you're absolutely right. You know, the container is everything. And the container includes the pre-work that you do, the ceremony itself, and the work you do after, and the person that you choose to do this with, or people that you choose to do this with. So, and your own intention. What is your intention? I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, the rave culture in England, they take Molly all the time, but they're not less, they have, you know, they don't have less rates of depression or PTSD or any of that. Though, you know, we think it's therapeutic and they keep going back to it. It's really that intentionality of your mindset going into it, and what you're trying to gain out of it. I see make that difference, you know?
I think that's a common mistake a lot of people make, and it's a little bit of a fallacy. And I think we talked about this briefly yesterday, that the chemical doesn't have the experience. The chemical doesn't have a personality or a wisdom. And a lot of times in psychedelic art, especially when you're talking about funguses, you know, the Amanita muscarias or psilocybin, there's this attitude that the plant itself has wisdom and or memory of all the users and that have ever ingested it, and the deer and everything before. You contrast that with a synthetic thing, whether that's, you know, ketamine or LSD, that arguably is just as profoundly psychoactive or psychedelic or entheogenic, or depending on what you're hallucinogenic, depending on what you're looking at. So you got these ancient plant sacraments that have been used by countless cultures and certainly millions and millions, if not billions, of people throughout history. But then you got all these new kids on the block that scientists in white coats in a lab invented. And then you have some endogenous ones like DMT. Why in the world is it there evolutionarily? Why is it so similar to other psychedelics? Yet if you and I drew our blood, it would be in our system right now. It's a common neural hormone found in the pineal gland that, I don't know if Rick Strassman brought that up in his book, but that tends to spike around the time of death. And it's one of the theories, I guess, of the etiology of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences and other dissociative states. But to me, that's proof that the chemical isn't what's got the personality or the lesson or the wisdom or the experience. The chemical is just a chemical that has to interact with your physiology in some sort of a transpersonal, psychedelic, spiritual way. But that's definitely going to depend exactly on what you were talking about. Intent, set and setting, a supportive environment, past experience. Some people don't get that choice. You know, I for one had a near-death experience when I was 6 years old, so it wasn't something I prepared for, but it certainly shaped my attitudes about consciousness and my interest in it my whole life. It's easier to go into a lab and inject someone with ketamine and study near-death experiences than it is to whack them over the head, or, you know, or like they.
I would love to hear what happened to you if you
Val Kilmer movie. At some point. Is that Val Kilmer, Flatliners? No, Kevin Bacon. And I just fell on my head. That's why I am the way that I am. But no, but I, you know, I did have that. That was my first sense of what people are talking about when they say out of body or seeing yourself from outside of yourself, or this whole concept of ego dissolution, which is quite disorienting the first time it happens. If you don't remember your name and really don't have a sense of your gender or your age, whether you're a parent or a child, or all of that slips away, but yet you're as aware, if not hyper aware, even more real than this version, this consensus reality. Is that what people are trying to connect with, so that healing ostensibly comes from that state?
Potentially, yeah. I think, you know, in that space, you see that it's the potentials are unlimited, you know, and having unlimited potential, then you're like, okay, if that's the case, then I can pick and choose what I want to implement in my life now. And I was just reading a research about the default mode network and what happens, yeah. Right? It's, you know, it's not activated during these states where in a normal activity of life, oh, I got to be on Mark's podcast at this time. I have my own podcast at that time. That's the default mode network working. And in these states, especially at higher dose, that state shuts off. And fMRIs, we don't see any activity there. And so this study had shown that after the mystical experience, after the high dose experience, the default mode network starts to reconstruct itself. And it's that during that reconstruction that I believe when integration matters most, right? That's when your life starts. You're like, oh, it's like starting from a blank slate. And here you go. How do you want to paint on this, right? And you've been given all these different colors. And you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because all at the same time that you feel infinite, there's that feeling of cohesion all at the same time. I don't know if I can put words to it really, but that's also a sense of responsibility. That's very significant, that you are significant. And your words are significant. Your actions are significant. All of that is also felt. It's a lived experience. And once you've experienced something like that, there's no unexperiencing it. So I feel like that has something to do with, you know, the changes that we see also.
Do you think I get the sense that we're dawning at some new age, new period of self-awareness, self-discovery. I'm cautious saying that because I feel like so many people have said that so many times throughout history. But to me, in my lifetime, something unique is going on right now in terms of the disconnectedness from each other. That, you know, what's it going to take to get people to remember we're all one, we all come from the same source, to connect more with their higher self and their spirituality? On one hand, you would have thought that the pandemic would have done that shared trauma, something mm-hmm. that we could all relate to, but it didn't. It didn't work, and the feasibility of large-scale psychedelics and where all the consequences of that would fall, it seems impractical to find a solution to get people to wake up,
mm-hmm.
spiritually, you know, speaking.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it's, you know, as you're talking, like there's a lot of lights that go off. So I'm going to take one thing at a time. Number one is isolation. We're not meant to be isolated. We, in fact, when we are isolated, we go into the sympathetic overdrive. That's why, you know, solitary confinement in the prison system, it is the worst punishment that you can give a human, right? And I love that we totally decided to erase that from us even knowing that, right? We know that evolutionarily, when, you know, we're herd animals and one of us would get lost in nature, you're probably dead. So, you know, our brain systems, their amygdala, the limbic system goes crazy when you feel in that type of a danger. You're like, I'm alone, I'm going to die. So what I saw, my husband and I talked about this significantly during the pandemic, knowing what isolation will do to us. And we predicted all of this as far as the mental health goes, you know, the separation, separatism, you know, and I think governments really like that because it gives them control over people, you know, like having a nuclear family. No, we're supposed to be in tribes and our children are supposed to have 4 caretakers per one. So that's 8 caretakers for 2 children, right? It's like not even a concept that we can wrap our heads around right now, because you're like, where am I going to get 8 people, right? But that's the reality of how we're supposed to be. That natural place where we are the happiest is within our community, connected to each other. Now, I also see that there is a shift in consciousness happening. Some of it is because of isolation. Some of it is because a lot of people that were super external and super stimulated with everything, they went internal. They're like, oh shit, there's somebody in here and I got to pay attention to her, to him.
Yeah.
Right. And so that was interesting to see. And what I see within my own country right now is an entire shift in consciousness where women are leading this. They're like, no more oppression, no more violations, no more. And I'm going to stand here. You can kill me. I don't care. And this is the new generation in Iran, from high school to like their 30, 35, like to 40s, you know, that's the generation that's like 60% of the country is that. Wow. And they care not at all about dying. They're like, no, we want freedom. And that's the new consciousness, you know? And so I think that discomforts that we're feeling inside of us is in the collective, you know, what's happening with Ukraine, what's happening in Iran, what's happening is it's a shift in consciousness, and we're all going to feel uncomfortable for a period of time. The only responsibility we have is that of self-discovery, and that's it. And to remember that, because sometimes we all get so overwhelmed with the shifts that are happening, you know, and we feel it, and you feel the wind within you as it's coming. But the more rooted you are in your own self-care and self-compassion practices, I call them conscious life practices because that's what they mean to me, the less you're going to move with the wind. And the more light we're going to have to bring into this world. And that's, you know, that's all we can do.
I can tell we're going to need to have you back for a part 2, because this is the holy grail of what we seek. And maybe the shift in the attitudes towards the psychedelic or in general, maybe the use of psychedelics and in medicine as it continues to evolve will be one tool. But I like a lot of these very concrete tools that people can use right now to make sure that they're not isolated, to make sure they're not like in the fight or flight vulnerable state, to make sure they're not focused on their 24-hour news network all day, every day, because we didn't evolve to absorb 8 billion people's problems. Focus on the family, the calm in the center of the storm, your community, your kids, your school, and maybe we can talk about conscious life practices more next time. Until
I love it. That would be wonderful. And can I put a plug in?
Plug.
How to connect with people. It's very simple. This is part of my, it's in my blood. I'm Persian. Connection is who we are. Get to know your neighbors. Like, it's, and it's simple, like smile at your neighbor, you know, that's it. It takes just that. If you see a neighbor who's a single mom or just a mom, whatever, connect with them. Just say, hi, hey, I'm a mom too. I'm a dad too. Connect on some very, very simple level on a daily basis. Like, we see our neighbors across. We're like, hey, what's up, Lawrence? You know, like, and then we exchange a few words of kindness and like, hey, how you doing? How's your day going? Simple. It's very simple to connect. Okay. It doesn't have to be this deep, crazy connection. Just start from small things. The other one that we actually implemented because we saw this coming within our neighborhood, we started having neighborhood gatherings.
Mm.
And, you know, I was pregnant at the time. I have a 2-year-old and a 14-year-old, and I was pregnant with my 2-year-old, was like 7 months pregnant, and it was in the middle of the pandemic. And I'm like, I'm done with this bullshit of isolation. Like, this is driving all of us crazy and it's not okay. And everybody's still afraid, but come on, like a year out, why are we afraid? We know the virus, we know who it's affecting. We know, anyways, being an internal medicine doctor, it's like, use your brain, right? And I was seeing the mental health effects and I was like, okay, let's do some. So I got the biggest pot that I could find from a neighbor and I made this huge thing of soup. And took a ladle out, texted, you know, all the neighbors, you know, that I knew and had the number for, set up a little table, told them to bring their own bowls and spoons and just like gave them a ladle of soup. And that's how we started. And so every like 3 months, we get together outside in somebody's, you know, backyard or not, on the street, on the cul-de-sac. Another neighborhood started doing a similar thing and they bring a food truck out like every Sunday and they all hang out around the food truck and they have food together. You know, there's no agenda. You're just being and you're just connecting. And in fact, it is making you so much healthier. Look up the Rosetta effect. It is an incredible study that shows community solidarity around just being together, food in an Italian immigrant population up in Pennsylvania. The study is a 50-year-long study looking at all-cause mortality, primarily looked at the cardiovascular death that was decreased 35% in this particular community who was smoking, drinking, eating all the pasta, all the things we're not supposed to be doing, but they had social solidarity, and that's why they were able to keep their mortality rates down by 35%, cardiovascular mortality and all-cause mortality.
Yeah, and that's all connected just to our overall sense of connectedness, health, and mental health and well-being.
That's it.
But I will put a link in the description below, not only for the Rosetta effect, but also so folks could check out your website, drlita.family.
Because we're all family.
Because we're all one. See, you get it.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful that you took the time today for us to wax poetic and solve the world's problems right here.
Right here, right now.
Right here, right now.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah.
I hope we could do a part two.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me know when. I'm more than happy to.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure having you, and we thank you again. We look forward till next time. Until then,
so grateful.
Be well.
Thank you. You too.